Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 31st of January already. I must confess that after I read the article in New York Magazine, I went to Facebook and tried to track down friends from high school. And I'm so old now, I couldn't find a lot of them. But this article prompted my desire to find friends from high school. Why you truly never leave high school. New science on its corrosive, traumatizing effects. It's an article in New York Magazine written by Jennifer Senior. And Jennifer is our guest this hour. She writes, for most of us adults, the adolescent years occupy a privileged place in our memories, which to some degree is even quantifiable. Give a grown adult a series of random prompts and cues, and odds are that he or she will recall a disproportionate number of memories from adolescence. The name for this is the reminiscence bump. Memories from the ages of 15 to 25 are most vividly retained. And there are many professionals who really have underrated the significance of those years. We'll talk about why they are so significant this hour of the program with Jennifer Senior, contributing editor for New York Magazine. She's been there for a number of years. She was also at the New York Times Magazine, and she covers politics, policy, and social trends. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we talk about the reminiscence bump and our high school years. This is going to be a fun hour. This hour, our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. For all of our high school friends, please make contact once again. Hello, Jennifer.
Hello. That was one of the most generous and comprehensive introductions I think I've ever heard of myself. Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer. And it's about to get more comprehensive because we're going to ask about going to your high school reunion.
What specifically would you like to know about it, Kathleen?
Well, you know, you started with these interesting stories of people who were kind of underrated, very bright, very talented in high school, and they came to the reunion and they were just spectacular. And it was pretty much, we could imagine what happened here. It's true that the people who are talented and kind of nerds and kind of on the fringe have many different lives than people who are the cheerleaders and the football players.
Okay, so there are two different things that I could talk about at this juncture. I could tell you just the one specific story that my magazine story opens up with, which is very funny and probably just worth mentioning, especially for any of your gay listeners who are, you know, in high school right now or, you know, feeling uncomfortable about
right.
it. One of my friends back then was this half-Japanese kid who was in the closet. I didn't know he was gay at the time. He graduated first in our class. He was a bassoonist in the orchestra. He had every possible signifier of nerddom one could attach to him. And when he showed up at the reunion, and I've seen him since, and you know, he shed the glasses, he's totally buff, he looks fantastic, he's out of the closet, he's brilliant and making a ton of money as an engineer. So he shows up at this reunion, and he's totally great. And he grabbed one of the triceps, I guess, of one of the handsomest football players at the school. And this guy was an identical twin. He grabbed him by his arm. He got his name right. I think he figured out which one it was. And he said, "Where's the after party?" Which is, of course, not at all the kind of thing that one would have imagined any of us having anywhere near the guts to do back at the time.
Right.
So that's a very heartening story. And what's interesting is that you could say that it's an outlier in the sense that, you know, what my story ultimately does is talk about the enduring kind of hidden psychological effects of those years. But this is clearly an example of someone who might have built his identity on a slightly rickety substrate from having been closeted for all that time, but he's just great now. Here's one thing, though, that you alluded to that I think is very important. The cheerleaders, the beautiful girls. There was a study that was done that just riveted me. It was a large sample size. It was fairly well designed. It was very funny. It was done in the 80s. It asked kids to identify what archetypical character they identified with most closely from The Breakfast Club. And then it sort of checked back in with these kids at 24, and they're checking back in with them now at about when they're all 40. And what was interesting is that the girls who had identified as princesses versus the girls who identified themselves as brains had switched places in terms of their self-esteem. The princesses had much greater self-esteem in high school, but by the time they were 24, they didn't. And the researchers suspect that they will not at 40. And the researchers say the reason they think, and this is very interesting, is that something that they learned in high school stuck, which is that they learned a certain kind of passivity. They were very dependent on luck and circumstance to get where they were. It didn't have anything to do with what they did.
Right.
It was all subjective judgments. It was like what they were. Were they pretty? Did they come in the right clothes? Were they deemed cool by whatever standards those were? And so it's very interesting to think that that really served them well for a while. But what might have happened as the years went by is that they just didn't learn how to make anything happen because they never had to.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the smart girls were all doing stuff. They were getting A's. They were working.
If only we could have young people in high school realize that now. It's a perpetual problem, isn't it?
I know. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, and I think that these categories are sort of enduring, is what's interesting. They're fairly durable. I mean, they've broadened with time because America has gotten more diverse, so there are now, there's goths, there's ethnic categories in high schools. But the fact is, jocks and princesses and, cheerleaders, that stuff is all, it's all still there at the top of the heap.
You're right, Jennifer, about the fact that professionals who are in the business of studying the human brain, really, and I know this because I've done shows for so long, for years we were looking at zero to three, the crucial years in figuring out who we're going to become and how we need to nurture people those ages, and we have neglected people who are between the ages of 15 and 25, and now we're starting to pay attention.
Yeah, great question. Okay, so this is what's interesting. I would say 20 years ago, no self-respecting neuroscientist or developmental psychologist would have said that the brain underwent any significant changes, really, between the ages of 15 and 25. People just assumed that you were more or less done. And if adolescents acted a little kooky, it was because they just basically were still adults with defective brains. I mean, people didn't have good explanations. They knew hormones were involved and things like this. What no one realized until very recently, and I think this is just so fascinating, is that the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of your brain that is responsible for reasoning, for controlling your impulses, for restraining your anxieties and suppressing your fear and rationalizing, that part of your brain is still undergoing massive changes between the ages of 15 to 25. And, I mean, if you really want to get kind of cheeky and funny about it, the one kind of institution that recognized this was car insurance companies, because they don't let anybody under the age of 25
That's right.
rent a car.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, they must have been staring at, statistics and actuarial tables and figuring out something that everyone else didn't, which is these people are not ready, and indeed they're not. So what's interesting is that if you look at a teenager and they seem like they are feeling things more intensely and they are more melodramatic and they are better and they are less suited to, and they can't reason as well, and that they can't self-regulate.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. Their brain isn't doing it for them yet. That part of the brain is still developing. It's still refining. It's unripe.
And so
I find that interesting.
And so it takes just chemically until the age of 25 for things to settle down.
Yeah, your prefrontal cortex is still developing. You're developing myelin. You're developing your the neural connections within your brain are hastening. They're speeding up, and they're also refining. It's this very complex process within the brain that involves both forming more neural connections and shedding the ones that matter less, and actually developing more of myelin, which is this kind of fatty white substance that improves kind of the efficiency of your brain. So it's this until you're about 25, it's not done. It's just not finished, which is a mind-blowing idea. And people tended to focus on 0 to 3 in some part because it was convenient. It's really easy to follow kids starting at birth. You've got a very discernible point from which to begin.
And then people are going to remember this from this conversation and from your article. You put together all of these people who are very poor models of self-regulation into a high school, into a big box, as you say. And you write, most American high schools are almost sadistically unhealthy places to send adolescents. Why?
Okay, well, let's start with this. I mean, And you know what? I mean, in hindsight, I mean, that language might have been a little strong. I mean, but I think here is my point. You've got all these kids who are, you know, extremely unregulated, right? Like, their brains aren't done.
Right.
And also, another thing about their brains, there's more dopamine activity going on in an adolescent brain than in any other time of, like, the human life cycle. So you are feeling things more intensely. You're taking more risks. You know, everything just feels that much more intense. You are putting all those people who feel things more intensely, who feel anxiety more intensely, who are taking more risks, you put them all in one building with not that many adults by comparison, right? Very, very poor ratios here of the, you know, number of children versus the number of adults. And they're spending all of their time now in the company of their peers. And by the way, this didn't used to be the case. Before the Great Depression, the majority of American teenagers didn't even go to high school, or they didn't graduate for sure. So they spent their time in the company of other adults. But now teenagers are just around other teenagers. So, you know, if the only thing you have in common with these kids is that they're your age and they seem to have they're in the same biological transition, they're going to make up their own rules about how, you know, what hierarchy should exist and how they ought to relate to one another. And those are not necessarily going to be the healthiest rules, especially considering that they are not getting, again, they're not mitigated or mediated by a lot of adult influence, right? I mean, it's mostly your peers. So to me, this just has all the makings of a disaster movie.
You interviewed a lot of people who've been studying all this. One of the people you interviewed said that who studied high school regression, said that because of this structure, it may reward aggression. And I'd like for you to talk more about that.
Yeah, so thank you. And yeah, that study, so it's a fellow named Rob Farris, who's a sociologist out in California. He's great. I think he's at UC Davis. Dear God, I hope I remembered that correctly. He's terrific. He pointed out some things that were both intuitive and counterintuitive. So first of all, you've got all these kids who have no discernible hierarchy to follow, so they've got to create them on their own, right? And, you know, high schools are big places, so what people tend to do is they tend to base them on pretty superficial things because you can't, the nuances of personality don't necessarily register in such large environments. So who looks great and who plays sports well, all the things that are kind of on the surface are, you know, probably for obvious reasons going to be, you know, assigned higher values. What this guy pointed out, though, was that if you want to get ahead, obviously the status-conscious kids are going to be more aggressive. That stands to reason. You know, you're sort of elbowing your way through. What I was fascinated by was his point that, however, the higher up you go through the high school hierarchy, the more vulnerable you also are to aggression. Which is to say, so really, really popular kids don't pick on super unpopular nerdy kids because there's no percentage in picking on someone who's so far down the food chain. You don't gain anything from it. There's no instrumental value, in doing that. There's what you gain is from picking on some. You gain something from picking on someone who's a rival or close to your rivals, right? So the higher up you go, you're going to be more and more fierce about scrambling to the top. I mean, we see this in reality television, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's sort of the way it works. And this guy made the point that there are a number of adult environments that replicate this, in large part because they are boxes of strangers, like reality television, where people vote one another off the island and scramble for position. In retirement homes, he was guessing, you know, in small villages. You know, just where there's no discernible hierarchy to be had, you know, aggression tends to be one of the ways that people just sort themselves through.
And the hierarchy, though, also seems to be kind of confused in terms of self-perception. I found the part of the article very interesting, that when you did a study of who friends were, who you thought were your friends, people had completely erroneous ideas of who they actually were.
This was probably the most shocking study to me. I agree. Okay, so this was a sociologist who looked at a huge, I mean, I think that it was in the tens of thousands sample of adolescents, and found that when asked to describe their close friends, the overlap was only about 37% of the time. I mean, this is the thing. You know, adolescents are notoriously poor readers of cues, and in part, this is because their brains, again, are still in transition. They're just not picking up all of the meta meetings yet, all of the, you know, things that require more reason. They're still these highly emotional, limbic kind of creatures. So, the other study that's kind of a companion to that was super small, like a very small pilot study, you know, minute sample, but still fascinating, was this neurologist, or neuroscientist rather, out in Utah, showed a group of adults a picture of a face. And you can see this online. The face is quite obviously, to me or you, a picture of somebody who's scared. Like, you just look at it and you go, oh, whoa, that person's scared. Mm-hmm. And every adult she asked in her study was like, yeah, that person's scared. But when she asked teenagers this question, they half the time got it completely wrong. They would say this person was angry, this person was sad. And as I wrote in my piece, I mean, that sort of sums up high school to me in a nutshell. It's like mistaking people's fear for some other emotion. I think it just all goes back to this idea you raised, which is that adolescents are just very bad emotional seismographs. They don't read cues well, emotional cues well.
Jennifer Senior is our guest this hour. We're going to open phone calls because we have people calling in already. I would have suspected that we would have a lot of phone calls on this because the title of the article is Why You Truly Never Leave High School. So all of us, unless we have people who are still in high school, can identify with this new science on its corrosive, traumatizing effects. It's in New York Magazine, and we welcome your thoughts. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Send an email if you'd like to do that. talk@wpr.org. And you can always leave a message on our Facebook page. She has something to say about Facebook pages, too, and how many of our high school friends are on Facebook. Our page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our two of our program today will talk about poetry. Several months ago, we did a show on poetry, and it was just extraordinary. You called in, so many of you are poets, and you were reading your poems, and we played poetry. I'm very anxious to meet our guest, who is the current Poet Laureate of the state of Wisconsin. Max Garland will be our guest. He hopes to reach out to those who may feel alienated from the world of poetry or art, and yet have, as he says, deeply felt experiences to record and honor. Because of this hour, I'm wondering what he was like in high school. He's a first-generation college student, and he left a 10-year career as a mail carrier in Kentucky to pursue his love of poetry. He's published several books of poems and has won many awards, and Max will be with us hour two. He is now teaching at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Two phone calls now for Jennifer. Why You Truly Never Leave High School is the topic this hour, and we go to Jody in Fond du Lac first. Hi, Jody.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to say, what a fantastic idea for a program. I'm a high school teacher, and I think I was actually drawn to this age group partly because of my experiences in high school. And, you know, I think I came to a realization, you know, that those years weren't as traumatic as they seemed. Often I think high school kids, you know, think the entire world is looking at them or, you know, I can see what's going on. And, you know, I think I came to that realization that, you know, that's really not the case. I that things aren't always as bad as they seem. But I think I kind of made it my mission to work with this age group, partly to get them to see that, you know, that there's just a different world, a different perspective. And I would say that I was myself maybe – I went to the nerdy girl, but, you know, definitely more focused on school and things like that. And I just thought this was just a great idea for a program. So thanks for sharing.
Yeah. But before you go, what do you think of the idea of putting all of these people who are still developing in one big box? Do you think that there's a better model for education at that age?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a huge difference between 9th and 10th grade students and 11th and 12th grade. And I think that just the maturity and the perspective is very different. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, there's some schools that are playing around with that idea of separating those two grade levels. And you know, maybe, that might be a better model. I guess it's kind of still in the works. But Yeah, I mean, I think that I've definitely observed a difference in maturity between, especially like 10th and 11th grade kids. It's kind of a marked difference.
Thank you so much, Judy, for calling. Jennifer, what about that model?
Well, it's totally intriguing. And I just want to say I love what she had to say. I mean, it was just such a... it was really a lovely response, and I think that her observation that the kind of looming perspective of high school while you're there, the fact that it diminishes over time, is totally true and consistent with the stuff that I found in my over the course of my research. That, you know, exactly, high schoolers are under the impression that, you know, all eyes are trained on them. There is just these intense feelings of shame and not belonging or feeling wrong about yourself that do go away with time. In terms of models, that's a really neat idea. A very simple fix that I've always been puzzled by, like why they never do this, is I know that when I was in high school, and maybe it's better now, but I just felt like we had so little contact with the adult world. Like we didn't go on trips to other people's kind of offices or places of work. You know, the world of work was very opaque to me. And I feel like something that could very simply be done is just having more people come in and talk, you know, adults coming in and talking to high school students about what they do during the day and getting them out, externships. I know that these are vague ideas, but I think the idea is that just a little more integration into adult life would be a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jody, so much for the call. Connie in Portage, hi.
Good morning. I was just wondering, now, my time frame is I went to high school in the 50s, and it was a little town of about 4,000 people in Oregon, Illinois. And in our school, I was one of the popular girls. I was a cheerleader and homecoming queen and all that. My friends were the ones who stood up with us, and my boyfriend was the jock, the best-looking one. But they all stayed that way. The girls that were, we called them the knitting group, they were very nice. But they had no personality, and they just were so dowdy, you know. And when I look back, and when we go to reunions and things, this is the way they've all stayed. Now, I don't know. I went to college at 40 years old and became an RN, but they don't seem to do anything, and they were the smart ones.
I mean, I got
A's and B's, but they were really smart.
Did you marry the jock?
No, I did not. I wish I could have. We went together and went into college together all through high school. But no, we did not marry. And I had 5 children, and I waited till my baby was 12 and went to college again. So.
So, Jennifer, how about that story?
So you're saying that the nerdy girls were sort of left behind in that case?
No. No, they were not left behind, because in the 50s, they didn't do that. I mean, nobody looked down on them. They were just, the names were like Virgetta and Gloria, and they were just, you'd have to see them. We called them the knitting group, and they fit right in, because they would never have gone to any of the parties. But they were very nice, and they came from good families. But they just lacked so much personality.
Okay, so, you know, here's what's interesting. It's a little bit different. If you're talking about high school in the 50s, that was the dawn of teen culture. It was the very beginning. So a lot of the categories from back then are still, you know, we're probably still evolving. I mean, before 1940, the majority of all teenagers didn't go to high school, or didn't complete it. So this is, you're really part of that first generation that did. And the other thing is that the opportunity horizons for women then, whether they were bright, whether they were not, you're a good example of this. You went to college at 40, right? You got your degree, you know, but first you had 5 kids. It was very different. So I think gauging the trajectories of women from that generation is extremely hard to do. I don't know how that could be done. There's a lot of very good work that actually suggests that if you were a jock, that whether you were a girl or a boy, it puts you in good standing. It shores up your esteem. And it's, of course, a chicken and egg question, right? I mean, you can ask whether, you know, ambitious and kind of self-assured people are already jocks. But the point is that people who seem to have done sports in high school tend to remain very confident people. They earn more money if they're men, you know, things like that. I was not trying to suggest in the beginning that the nerdy girls, you know, come out and then conquer the world. Indeed, the beautiful girls get married first. If you're more beautiful, you're more likely to marry. It's a complicated picture. What I was interested in is simply that they had learned passivity at that age, too, so they didn't seem to know how to go out in the world and do things for themselves. And this is, again, we're talking about a sample that was looked at starting in the 80s when they could have gone out and done stuff for themselves.
Yeah, so much has changed since Connie was in high school. You think about those smart girls, maybe they were knitting, maybe they could have been nuclear physicists or something.
They could have been Hillary Clinton. We don't know.
Yeah, exactly. No. It's when you think about that, it's a remarkable change in the role of women, isn't it, Jennifer?
Oh, completely. And again, it's a confound in terms of sort of looking at these questions, because, again, opportunities didn't open for them until,
right.
I mean, you could say 1968, but it was really even after that that it became standard for mm-hmm. women to just pour out into the workforce, you know?
So. Thanks, Connie, very much for the call. Laura in Madison, hi.
Oh, hi. This is so interesting. I went to an all-girls Catholic high school, and my whole life I've heard about these mean high schools and how mean kids in high school are. I never experienced that. People were nice. And so I'm wondering if your guest has any information on how much it is competition for dating and boys or something that makes people mean in high school, because I didn't experience it in an all-girls school.
You are pointing out a glaring flaw in my story. You're absolutely right. I didn't look at sex segregated schools. I didn't look at specialty high schools, which are probably better, you know, if they're performing arts high schools or they're competitive schools where brains matter. There are all sorts of settings that can mitigate this. I was talking about the generic American public high school that was co-ed. I was not looking at like parochial schools or single sex schools. And I have been on a number of shows and had a number of conversations with people since where they've said, gosh, you know, I went to an all girls school and it was great. So you know, when I hear a comment like this, I think, yes, you know, I wish I had addressed that in the piece, and I don't have any good data on it. I have only what I have heard anecdotally since, which is very much along those lines. And yes, look, what we do know certainly about co-ed high schools is that, of course, hierarchies tend to form, are organized based on, you know, how appealing you are to the opposite sex. So it totally stands to reason, of course, that if you remove that from the equation, you know, it's going to be much easier. You're not going to have the same kind of ridiculous competition about who looks so terrific every day. And I mean, I think it eases things quite a bit.
I think you should do a book on this, Jennifer. There is so much response.
Why do you say that?
Are you doing that?
Well, no, I'm completing another book now. But you know, I need another project. Maybe this will be it.
Right. I think it is. There's phenomenal interest in it.
Thanks,
Laura, very much for your call, Michael in Milwaukee.
Yeah,
hi, Michael.
Hello. I'd like to bring in a male perspective. I'm a retired high school teacher myself, and I've also been active in the men's movement. And one of the things I read some time ago is, you know, the hardest job for a male in American society today is teaching in an inner city high school. And I realize that's bringing, you know, social and class into it as well. But I'd like to see your guest thinks of that. I found it a difficult job. Maybe I still had some of my high school attitudes, like, you know, responding to, you know, the male student challenge of, you know, hey, do you think you're tough, that kind of thing. So, and not that it's that much easier for a female, but, you know, I'd like to hear her response.
Wow. Okay. Well, first of all, bless you for teaching. And also, if you were in that kind of environment, that sounds really challenging. I think that actually, I'm going to go to a body of literature that I mentioned in my story, which is about shame and vulnerability. First of all, in high school, we ourselves feel, you know, tons of shame. You know, if you consider shame this kind of crippling feeling that you don't feel like you belong, that you feel like everybody's looking at you and that you're not deserving of fellowship and companionship and that you're, you know, you must be different in some way. And for men, I think feeling vulnerable and like you're not strong is just one of the big, you know, when I talked to Brené Brown, who is a longtime shame researcher at the University of Houston, she says that this comes up habitually for men. So if your high school impression of yourself is that you're, you know, not especially tough, and you carry that into adulthood, and then you are teaching in an environment of extremely tough kids, I can imagine that being a huge trigger. I don't know what you were like in high school, and, you know, you might have the way that you might have handled your own shame might have been by fighting aggression with aggression. You might have withdrawn. You might have tried to ingratiate yourself. I don't know how you handled it. But to then be re-surrounded by tons of aggression, I would think as a man, would really trigger all those anxieties about not wanting to be the kid who was shoved up against the lockers when you were 16 years old. So I can understand how that would be much more fraught in some ways for a man than for a woman. It kind of, in a funny way, would make sense to me, just because, you know, of all the reasons I've just said, psychically, I think it's really where the shame kind of is for men versus women.
Jennifer, it seems to me as though one of the reasons that we would go to high school or we go to school is to become smart, you know, to learn things and to be able to figure out what strikes our fancy and what we're good at doing and how we want to make a contribution to the world. You write that there is, and we hear this again and again, that there's a liability to be smart. And you write about high school values being not all that different from adult values. Most adults don't like cello or marching bands. Either they are suspicious of intellectuals. If you put adults in a similar situation, a giant building full of strangers with few common bonds, you will find similar behaviors. What does that say about America?
Well, oh gosh, you know, that's a large topic. Let me put it this way. I spoke to an anthropologist named Mimi Ito. Oh, where is she? I want to say Berkeley. And she studies two things. She studies social networks, and she studies, she does a lot of work with teenagers in Japan. And she told me when she and I chatted on the phone, this is not in the piece, but it speaks directly to this question. She said, you know, teenagers in Japan are not ridiculed for being bright. Right, but Japanese culture also prizes its intellectuals. The emphases are different there. So, you know, I mean, here's the truth. There are some places that absolutely treasure musicians and intellectuals in the United States. I happen to live in one of those places. You know, I came to New York City, and I'm at liberty to surround myself with as many nerds and as many musicians as I like. Mm-hmm. And none of us will give each other a hard time. But, you know, I think that what I found interesting and what I kept asking everybody who studied high school is, I don't get it. Why? High school is designed to make you smart. As you said, high school is designed to make you smart. So why is it that there you are doing the thing that, you know, high school is telling you to do and, you know, you're not getting handsomely rewarded for it necessarily? And a lot of them would say what I eventually wrote, which is that, well, it's not, you know, intellect is not a huge American value. It is in some places, but not across the board. The other thing that people would say to me is that you can be smart up to a point in high school. You know, it's not like ditziness is especially well tolerated. Being smart up to a certain point is fine. It's okay. It's even good. It's just that there comes a tipping point where you can be too smart. Hmm. That's really what, you know, the impression I got from talking to a bunch of sociologists about this.
Jennifer Senior, our guest this hour, her piece I'm sure you're going to want to read in New York, and we hope eventually she'll do a lot of exploration and write a book about this with some recommendations for changing the whole way we educate people at this age. Would be interesting, huh? The piece is Why You Truly Never Leave High School, New Science on Its Corrosive, Traumatizing Effects. And I don't know if Rhonda can hear me. Do we have this on our Facebook page? The article's on our Facebook page, too. Aren't you lucky? So you can go to the Kathleen Dunn Show, read the article, and give us your comments about your high school experience and some of what she's suggesting, that maybe we want to look at a whole different way of education because of what's happening in our brains when we're this young. Why do we remember so many songs from this time period, too? And do we ever move beyond that? We'll ask her that, too. We have one line open. Actually, two lines open. Thank you, Michael, for your call. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Hour two of our program today, we're looking forward to meeting the current poet laureate of the state of Wisconsin, Max Garland. He is the laureate for 2013 to 2014. His poetry has been praised for its richness of language, human understanding, and I think this is important, accessibility to broad audiences. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jennifer Senior is our guest, contributing editor at New York Magazine, and we go to Jim in Milwaukee next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Great topic, Kathleen. Thank you. I grew up in the 50s in high school, and I was a brain in history and got put down for it by a guy that wanted to build himself up by putting other people down. And it was a difficult situation for me, but ultimately I wound up being a treatment social worker in the prison system, and I learned a lot of things later in life that improved myself in terms of self-esteem. But the thoughts that are paramount in my mind is that I was lucky getting through my life experience and that I missed out on a lot. And I think that high school kids need work in reading cues. I think they need work in knowing how to handle bullies, avoiding bad choices. And also, at least for my generation, they never developed a questioning attitude in terms of looking at society. And as a result, there's a carryover, a lot of bigotry and closed-minded, ignorant thinking, at least to my point of view. But I got through all of it, but even at the end, because of the suffering that I went through in high school and in college because of my shyness and not having anybody to talk to about it, I still have some residual anger and lack of trust and not wanting to get close to people. So I think skills for kids in this age group are paramount.
Jennifer.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very moved by this. I mean, number one, because there are two pieces that move me. I mean, first of all, what you said about not being sort of trained to challenge the pre-existing order, that must have been very, very hard in the 50s as well, when the whole country was in the middle of, you know, sort of walking in lockstep and trying to normalize after the war. So, I mean, it was especially discouraged when you were coming of age. So that sounds pretty rotten and pretty hard if you're a different kind of kid or a brainier kind of kid. The other thing is that I think it's so interesting that what you chose as your life's work was to sit there with a bunch of former bullies, essentially, right, in the prison system.
Yes,
men who had tons of trouble with aggression. And, I mean, it was almost like you were trying to figure out who these terrorists were. And, you know, God bless you for doing it. And it seems like a very healthy way of coping with a very early kind of ugly experience with aggression yourself. I have a question for you. If you know the answer, I'd be curious. What happened to that kid who was picking on you all the time? Do you know where he is now?
Well, he went to a good school. I'm from Illinois. He went to Northwestern. He got his degree, but the high school sweetheart that he was with, he got divorced. Was involved with a divorce from her. I don't know of any of the particulars, but what comes
around.
But I bet
he's making a lot of money.
It seems to me.
Right. Well, that could be. But what's interesting is that I mean, what I found slightly discouraging about, you know, both going to my own reunion and also staring at the hard data is that, you know, a lot of the times the aggressive guys just go on and that aggression serves them well in life in the sense that, you know, they make a lot of money and whatever. I mean, they might get divorced. I don't know whether the rates of divorce are higher among, you know, jocks or anything like that. But, I mean, they make more money, you know. And so it doesn't – you'd like to see some kind of cosmic justice in these situations. But, again – this is kind of the place where people learn rules, and if they are rewarded for aggression, they go out into the world and, you know, they continue to be aggressive. And there are certain professions that reward aggression more than others. And so, you know, he went to a good I'm interested sometimes. I mean, mm-hmm. I was interested in the number of kids who came back who were bullied then who are now, you know, bankers and raking in money hand over fist and who, in a couple of cases, were central to the crisis of 2008 and who are still living in giant houses and doing really well. You know, and I mean, you just stare and go, well,
right.
You know, there's not much to say to that. I mean,
Yes, there is. You just say money isn't everything.
Well, right. No, absolutely. Yeah. And I don't think it is. I have no idea what their interior lives are like.
Right.
Nothing. Or their marriages. I have no clue.
What's interesting to me is that, Jim, and every time we do a program on bullying, I'm absolutely amazed how people remember exactly what happened. They remember the incident, how they felt, how it affected their lives for many, many years, which really reaffirms what you've been saying, that those are such crucial years, this imprint on our mind. We remember the people, we remember the songs, and sometimes we have to go into therapy to overcome some of the bad that happens to us.
I have a question for Jim, which is, does he ever... Do you also remember anyone who might have done something special for you in that time and intervened when this bully was acting up? Because sometimes, those become privileged memories too. We remember the people who spared us. And the person who talked to me a lot about this was the Rosalind Wiseman, who wrote Queen Bees and Wannabes, which turned into Mean Girls. Yeah, yeah. So I'm just curious.
I don't remember anybody in specific, but throughout my life, I've always done a lot of effort to do reading and to get new ideas and new perspectives, and that's basically how I came to the insights. My father, who was the best person in my life, passed away when I was 17, mm-hmm. and there were just some dysfunctional things with my mother and my brother, but I just kept reading and kept searching, and that's how I improved my situation.
Thank you, Jim, so much for your call. Let's go to Laura on Facebook, who asks, after conducting your research, Jennifer, would you send your children to a traditional high school, or would you seek out other options like specialized schools or homeschooling?
That's a really great question. I mean, and, you know, I hate to say it, it's like, did I even have to do research to have instincts about this? I mean, I went to high school, too, so, you know, I have thoughts. I think homeschooling's out of the question. I work, and I'm not going to – I think that wouldn't work for my family and my family situation. I don't think it's – I mean, I have no objection to it. For anybody who can pull it off, I think it – you know, I don't see any reason why not. I think specialty high schools are interesting. I'm in New York City, and there are a lot of them, you know. So you can – if you're vigilant. I also have to see – I have one kid. I have to see what kind of kid he turns out to be and, you know, follow his cues. And – if he winds up being a more sensitive kid, I'm certainly not. He's only five now, you know. But I will absolutely think long and hard about what kind of setting I put him into, whether it's single sex, specialty, playing to his strengths, or just one of these. You know, I mean, private schools are very expensive here, and they're a different kind of world. But some are different from others. Some are very sensitive to kids' needs. I just don't know. Maybe I'll have a jock. Who knows? You know, I don't really know what I'll have.
Sue in Janesville. Hi, Sue.
Good morning. I'd like to commend the man who just mentioned how he did reading, and this helped him. I was a bookish kid in high school in the 60s, and naturally enough, I became a librarian. And when I was studying librarianship in the 1980s, in my young adult literature class, studies were showing that the books teenagers read between the ages of, say, 14 and 20 were the most influential books that a person would read in one's life.
Oh, that's
interesting. And I kind of agree with that. You can think of the books that you read as a teenager.
Sure.
So
totally.
I'd like to put in a plug for a well-designed curriculum with certain things being read in English class, but also optional recreational reading available for young adults, because through young adult literature, you can live alternate lives and experience other situations and get guidance from fiction on the fact that you're not alone in adolescence.
Can I add a modern piece to that? I think that a lot of young kids, it's so interesting what you say, right? It stands to reason that it would be like music. I mean, the stuff that you kind of sweep in at that age is especially adhesive. And I now think about all the kids who are teenagers who go online and do fan fiction and get really lost in kind of writing their own versions of stories and, you know, of pre-existing kind of stories that are out there and stuff. And again, I think it's this way of kind of you choose that alternate universe for yourself. And there's just a lot of teenagers are very passionate about this stuff, you know, writing fan fiction and stuff. And it's just another creative way for kids to express themselves, especially if they're bookish and they find their own people. And they're not bounded by geography, right? They can find kids all over the country who also think that the fiction of Lois Lowry is great or whatever, you know? So
she talked about a good curriculum, and I think about great teachers during those years as well, that they really helped guide my life. I can remember them vividly now, what the classroom was like and the books that we read, and you're formulating your values in some way. And if you have somebody who's really at the top of her or his profession and can impart values and great literature, oh, it's important.
Yeah, I think that the adult influences are highly crucial. Also, you know, something to be said here. Just, I mean, the literature we could certainly talk about, and it's true, but you're just reminding me about the teachers. You know, some teachers are a little bit complicit themselves with perpetrating the ugly values of high school, and they don't even mean to be, but they will, even the best intentioned ones will pile on in ways that they don't realize, or, you know, the high schools themselves kind of overprivileged football games, right? It's not like they have homecoming for track, mm-hmm. right? Or for orchestra. So, you know, it's important, I think, for teachers also to, you know, mediate these influences too. And a great curriculum is great. I mean, the only reason that I'm not jumping on that is because, you know, I mean, I read Catcher in the Rye. I read lots of books at that age that were about teenage alienation, and they were great, and they helped me, you know, kind of, they helped explain some of what was going on. But, you know, I think having an embodied experience with other human beings who can put their arms around you and say, it's going to be okay, really right. also matters. Books are, you know, inanimate still. So,
Sue, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Marie in Superior. Hi, Marie.
Hi, I'm dealing with a 14-year-old who is very smart and kind of an outcast in school. She's been bullied, and I think a lot of parents are the culprits of this, even when we talk, and she's doing well now, but parents want to talk about sports and dance and competition and all how well their children do, but when you bring up academics, there's almost a jealousy. They'll just stop you in your tracks, and you can spend an hour talking about how well a hockey game went, but we don't give a lot of accolades to kids for winning the Knowledge Bowl or the Spelling Bee or the Science Fair or those types of things. And it's kind of what our society is.
You're absolutely right, I think. Jennifer.
Exactly. That's why I was saying, you know, I mean, I only wish that there was a homecoming for the Knowledge Bowl. I mean, that sounds great. You know, I mean, can you imagine that world? I mean, it would change the picture for your 14-year-old considerably.
Mm-hmm.
But, right, parents are complicit in this culture, too, you know. And as I said in my story, you know, to some extent, adult values and kid values are the same, you know.
Yeah. Thanks, Marie. I'd like to get quickly to the final two calls, if we can do so. Jill in Madison, hi.
Hi. I actually am an educator, so I've worked with high schoolers and actually younger kids, too. And in high school, I was sort of nerdy. I guess I'd say I'm kind of was the middle road, where I could get along with most anybody, but I wasn't super popular.
That's exactly who I was. I understand that very well.
Yeah, I played in the orchestra, and I did all that stuff, and I got good grades. I wasn't a hard-driving academic. I mean, you know, I wasn't up all night studying. But anyway, I have someone very close to me in my life who was equally smart, also has a graduate degree, but was much more popular, and this person has had a much more pressure on them, I think, socially, as an adult, to maintain a home, to maintain appearance, to maintain things that, you know, me with my, you know, funny shaved weird designs in my hair, I didn't have that as an adult, you know. It could only go up from there, right? So, but
I love that.
There's a lot of pressure on some mm-hmm. of these people who are quite popular in school, and then they're expected to maintain that, whereas someone like me, and I heard or read in something recently saying that sometimes the middle of the road kids are the happiest kids.
Jennifer?
So, okay, I'm so glad you brought this up. I can't even tell. I'm collapsing in gratitude over here because, let me tell you, something that didn't make it into my story, we cut it out at the last minute to save space, but it's so relevant, is that popular kids in high school often, although their self-esteems are higher, there's lots of studies to show that they are still just as anxious as everybody else. You'd think they would be less anxious because they're confident, and you'd think that confidence and anxiety would, you know, kind of correlate, but No, because there is something very precarious about popularity. And as you said, your friend feels pressure. You have to stay popular. You have to stay beautiful. You have to stay well-groomed. You have to keep up appearances. There, if, in fact, status is important to you, then, you know, you are constantly looking in your rearview mirror and to your left and to your right. And it's not as comfortable a place to inhabit.
And, Jennifer, we have to say goodbye at that point. We're out of time. Thank you so much. It was a great hour. Enjoy.
Thank you. It was great.
Jennifer Senior, the article is in the current issue of New York. We have it on our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show, Why You Truly Never Leave High School, New Science on Its Corrosive, Traumatizing Effects. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and for doing on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody.